Hello and welcome to Crime Time FM. My name's Paul Burke and I write about crime fiction. And the Crime Time podcast is the perfect opportunity to interview writers about their novels. Today my guest is James Wolfe, and he's the author of two spy novels, Beside the Syrian Sea and How to Betray Your Country. We spoke last June, some of you may remember, when How to Betray Your Country was first released. And that interview is still available if you're interested, so please do check that out. But we're going to be covering new areas today, of course. But a lot's happened since June last year, and James Wolfe is becoming recognised as one of the finest upcoming spy writers. He shot straight into Tim Shipman's Spybury Top 125 Spy Writers as a wildcard, and on this show, Frank Gardner name-checked him, noting that his work could only be written by somebody who had a real insider knowledge. So I wanted to follow up on some of the things we discussed and see what's happened in the intervening months, and remind all fans of literary spy fiction that James is one of our top authors. There is, however, an intriguing aspect to interviewing James. For reasons I'll let him explain before we start the interview proper, James Wolfe is not his real name. So, James. Until last year, you worked as a civil servant in a sensitive role. Can you explain why you want to keep your identity a secret? We'll just do that quickly, please.
Yes, I can. Yeah, I know it's a little bit of an awkward thing because obviously I'm in this position of trying to talk about my books and to introduce readers to them, but at the same time I'm being a little bit discreet about myself and my own position. As you said, until a couple of years ago, I worked in the British government, and as you might expect, when you go into that sort of world and when you leave it, you're required to sign all sorts of pieces of paper just to remind you of your legal obligation to be discreet about what you've done and where you've gone and who you've met and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I think for all of those reasons, I can't really discuss my career in any sort of detail. And I think, you know, for obvious reasons, it can be quite hard to separate the individual from their career. So I think in situations such as this, it's felt that it's best for the individual to be as discreet as possible, bearing in mind, as I said, that, you know, I am trying to publicize the book at the same time. I think Boris Johnson famously said a few years ago in the Brexit context that he wants to have his cake and eat it. And I think I find myself in the same position here, that I want to you know, have these sort of conversations with you and talk about the book. But at the same time, there's certain things I just can't discuss.
No, it's fair enough. And you've made it clear to people. I think we can all understand that. I was actually listening to a podcast the other day with David McCloskey, who was a CIA analyst.
Yes.
You've heard of him then, yeah?
I have, yeah. And how does he get around this?
Well, is that his real name,
or was that a pen name?
No, I think it's his real name. And I've seen the man being interviewed. Of course, his novel is Damascus Station for people who are listening. But what he said was basically he's just accepted that there will be an oversight of his work before it's published for the rest of his life if he keeps writing spy books.
Yeah, I think there is also quite a different culture in the UK than there is
right,
in the
yes.
US. I mean, I think the CIA has something, I can't remember the name of it, but it has a particular internal office, something
yes.
like, let's say, the Office of External Affairs or Media Affairs or something like that, that actively engages with Hollywood to promote a, you know, positive.
Yes, right.
And or, you know, realistic, depending on your perspective, portrayal of American spying in the movies. And he's also involved in vetting the manuscripts of lots of former CIA and, I suppose, FBI officers who leave and write books. So it seems that there is a much more established pathway in the US to doing this, whereas I think in the UK it's a little bit less common and a little bit less straightforward, perhaps.
Yeah. No, well, I was thinking, actually, there was something I remembered just now. Charles McCarry, who started writing in the Cold War, he was a former CIA officer. And I think he said that they had a scheme at that time to encourage CIA officers to write a book, but then put it in an archive. In other words, really? To try and get it out of their system, if you like, you know, the things that were there that they wanted to talk about that they then wouldn't be able to talk about in public.
As a kind
Interesting.
Of therapy, you know,
yeah.
to sort of exercise your demons before you go out and join the real world. Charles McCarry, in fact, is responsible for one of my favorite quotations about spying. He said that there were, you know, during his, I think, 10-year plus clandestine career in the CIA,
right?
He said that there were two types of people he never met in the CIA. And the first was an assassin and the second
right.
was a Republican, which is a wonderful line. And it really gives you an insight, I think, which is into something which is true in the UK as it is in the US, which is that these are communities that are very, you know, perhaps in contrast to people's perception of what they are likely to be. These are communities that are very, you know, liberal and internationalist and, you know, believe in negotiation and compromise. Mm. All of these things are deeply rooted in spine culture.
Yeah, thank you, James. Well, I'll leave that hanging there, but if that doesn't intrigue you, I don't know what will. So let's crack on and chat to James Wolfe. Hello and welcome back to Crime Time FM, James.
Thank you. Very nice to be with you.
Well, it's really great to have you back, James. I've explained to people in the introduction that we've already talked once, of course, about How to Betray Your Country when it came out. And of course, that's still available so people can listen to that. And I've also played that little piece where we talked about why you write under a pseudonym. So I think now we can just crack on with the interview. So what I thought we'd do today is we kind of catch up as we haven't spoken for a few months and see how the third novel is coming along and perhaps follow up on some of the stuff we chatted about back then. No, but of course, first of all, how are you, James?
Yeah, good, very well. Been busy since we spoke last. But yeah, all very well and making good progress with book three.
Ah, good. All right. That's lovely. That's good to hear. So we do understand why you write under a pseudonym, but I have a kind of question related to that. Just one thing to start off with, though, along these lines. So you respect the secrecy of the work you did, and that's fair enough, of course. But did that in any way influence the type of story that you were then writing when it came to that first novel? I mean, did you avoid anything in particular? Is there sort of an absence, I suppose, is what I'm asking?
Yes. I think when I started to think about writing the first book, I had in mind a fairly traditional framework.
Right.
I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was something like, you know, maybe there's an incident, a terrorist plot, something like that, and then the agency, you know, kicks into gear and, you know, starts doing this and that in order to try and foil the terrorist plot. But I very, very quickly realized that if I wanted my book to be realistic in any way, then I was going to have to describe or try to describe some of the real steps that agencies actually take in these mm-hmm. situations. And you immediately then get into a very, very difficult conversation with the censor, in which you say, well, I'm trying to be realistic. And they say, well, we appreciate that. But, you know, in being realistic, you are divulging techniques that I use today. And if people
right.
read about these techniques, they might modify their behaviors. So rather than write a book and then have that conversation, which is, to be frank, one that I wouldn't win,
mm-hmm.
I started thinking very early on about how to get around this. And the way I came up with was to take my protagonist out of the organization. So they and this is true of both the first books, so Beside the Syrian
yes.
Sea and How to Betray Your Country. So in both cases, there are spies who work within the organizations and then for different reasons find themselves on the outside and then have to try and use, I suppose, their professional instincts or tradecraft or professional skills that they have developed without the resources that a spy agency would draw on
mm-hmm.
in order to survive and in order to achieve their objectives. So it did. It really closed off a lot of the kind of subject matters that a lot of people would write about when
yeah.
writing a spy book.
Could you argue then, though, that made you more inventive? Or was it that you had this leaning anyway? I mean, starting with that basic idea, your stories are about outsiders. But there's a nuance to that. I mean, when it came to that first novel, Beside the Syrian Sea, was that the origin point, just that, the outsider?
It's very hard to say what one of the origin points was I had the first scene of the book very clearly in my mind. I had this idea of a young British man, you know, looking pretty terrible, standing in the rain mm. on a Beirut street opposite a brothel, watching someone go in. And it was kind of just frozen in my mind as an evocative scene. And it felt like it developed a kind of energy of its own that I wanted to develop and see through. I came across this very good quote from the American experimental short story writer, Donald Barthelmy, recently, in which he said, a writer is someone who, when faced with a task, does not know what to do, or something like that. That's just a poor approximation of it. But that really struck a note with me, because I felt with both of the books that I start off with an idea that I feel is going to carry me in a certain direction, and invariably it carries me in a quite different direction. So I think
right.
this theme of outsiders that you identify that is, you know, you're absolutely right, is certainly there, is a very strong current within the books, is not one that I thought was going to be there. It's not something that I thought preoccupied me. But I wrote the first book about this character, Jonas, who was an analyst and whose father was kidnapped and who was very much an outsider figure. And I had no intention of that being the first part of a trilogy. And then I came to write the second book and I just found that I was writing about another outsider. And a lot of the same preoccupations were resurfacing.
Yes.
And I think this is, you know, from the perspective of the person doing the writing, this is one of the fascinating things about the whole process, that it's such a long and slow and solitary process that it does surface all sorts of things in your mind that you weren't expecting to find. I mean, I've heard it described as, you know, the writer's mind as being a bit like a compost heap. You know, stuff is piled up there and it just kind of changes organically and becomes something different.
Well, organic.
And you don't know what that is until it appears on the page.
Yeah. Organic's the interesting word there, because, I mean, very much in the way you write, it's there. I was talking to Dean Koontz actually a while back, and he was saying that he doesn't know where he's going with his story. He writes a page, and he refines the page, and he refines the page, and then his mind is sort of working on what the next page will be, and it goes that way. So he literally starts with almost no idea of where he's going. He just starts with a scene or a character and builds up from there. But I want to talk about your character as an outsider, or your characters as outsiders. And let's take either character, it doesn't matter which, but perhaps Auguste fits this more. When we talk about an outsider, yours is a slightly complex version, because if we look at something like Harry Palmer, who's the man with no name in the Len Dayton books, you know, Ypcris File, Funeral in Berlin, and Billion Dollar Brain. His character is an outsider in the sense that he joins the service, and the service is very much the public school boys, you know, the money, the background, and he's a street urchin. He's a crook. He's a working class boy. You know, there's nothing about him that fits. So he's a genuine outsider. Now, that's not quite the same with your characters, though, is it?
No, it's not. You're quite right. So so August, the character, the protagonist of How to Betray Your Country, I think doesn't start the book, or doesn't start his career as a spy, feeling like an outsider. But I suppose one of the key things in his life is the episode in which he meets his future wife Martha, and she has a whole set of very legitimate objections to his career. It's easy to imagine what they are, that the work is manipulative, that people's lives get damaged, that there's a huge amount of secrecy and lying that goes on, that the British government finds itself in partnership with some quite unpleasant regimes overseas, and that it justifies all of this in the greater good. You know, that when matters of national security and economic prosperity are on the table, you know, governments have to, you know, do the necessary thing and have these difficult relationships and act ruthlessly in order to protect their citizens. And, you know, I'm not saying that that is a wrong set of arguments, but
no.
I think she finds Martha, his wife, finds all this really difficult. And the kind of compromise they reach as a couple one drunken night, and it is a kind of, you know, a drunken resolution that August makes, is that each year he will carry out an act of disobedience in order to prove that he remains independent and his own man, and, you know, not just a cog in the machine, that he's capable of not following orders, of breaking rules, if it's something that he thinks is right. And so over the years, he carries out this series of, you know, ethical breaches or you know, whatever one might call them. And it's this kind of journey that is triggered by meeting his wife that leads him into this position he's in at the start of the book, which is that of an outsider. So he, you know, he starts off in some ways a kind of establishment figure, you know, public school educated and from a wealthy family, certainly, you know, dysfunctional in some ways, and a difficult relationship with his family and all of those sort of things going on. But his relationship with Martha, with his wife, is what leads him to the place where we find him at the beginning of the book.
Yes. Now, what I was thinking about that was that what's happening here is these are insiders in a sense. Both Jonas, but particularly August, until a point of something happening. And of course, it's the case of Jonas, it's his father being kidnapped. In the case of August, it's his wife getting killed in a road accident. Is it, is that, I'm just wondering how you got to the characters, because I know that we've talked before in the past and it was about characters are difficult, and that makes perfect sense, of course, it should for any writer. But was it the fact that you got this pivotal event, if you like, and at that point you have to find out how the character will react and change and do things differently to what's normally expected? Is that how you got into the characters, or was it something else?
Yeah, I think that's a very good way of putting it. I mean, it's, you know, I guess tension or difficulty or crisis is what reveals character. You know, when things are good, we have this idea of how we are as people and our capabilities, and, you know, we consider ourselves robust and you know, functioning and all those kind of things. Yeah. And then something goes wrong, and then it's at that moment that you discover what you're really like as a person. I think for both of these characters as well, it's also the moment at which they discover the character of the organization they work for. So, you know, there is a huge amount these days about, you know, making spy agencies modern, diverse organizations. And that work is much needed and, you know, to be praised, and in many ways has been very successful. And they're very different organizations than they were a generation or two generations ago. But I think there is probably a kind of essential characteristic, you know, I would hesitate to say behind the mask, because that makes it sound a bit duplicitous. But, you know, these are organizations that exist to intrude covertly on the lives of other people.
Right.
And they are entrusted with national security, which is an incredibly important thing. And so I think, for example, with Jonas, he finds himself in a position where, you know, he's desperate to release his father, and the organization, the agency, sees itself threatened by that and immediately acts to cut him off. So he discovers himself in the process, and he also discovers something about the character of the organization he was working for.
And I suppose the other people around him, because what you're saying there is something that we're noticing. I mean, when we talk about the police and we talk about institutional corruption, you know, I'm not sure people fully understand what that means in a sense, but in a sense, it's adopting that corporate mentality, isn't it?
It exactly is. And it's so easy to look at another culture, another organization, once something has come to light, and shake your head and you look at it and think, how could that, you know, these terrible people, how could this have been allowed to happen? I suppose when I was in government, I was sometimes thinking, well, look, if you look back at any previous generation, there are scandals that have emerged. There are things we look back on, you know, almost every decade and think, goodness, how was that allowed to happen?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you think, well, actually, I'm probably in the middle of something now that is going to be equally shocking to future generations. And what is my stance towards that? What do I think about that? And so I think we have to take a good look at ourselves as well, and not be too judgmental about previous generations.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point, actually. I agree. I think that it's something I'm wishing more fiction actually did do that. You know, I mean, I think, for instance, particularly with crime fiction, I don't think I think it gets individuals as corrupt. I think it's very good at identifying problems, but not in this broader sense, not quite grasping this overall, you know, this thing that can kind of corrupt because of money or power or whatever it is, but the kind of thing that develops around that. Anyway, you know what it makes me realize, though, when you're talking about August there, is how important his wife's character actually is. She's off the page, effectively, but everything starts and finishes from her, really, doesn't it?
It does. I think she's the moral center of the book. I mean, I'd started writing it before I realized. I mean, I also sort of hate that thing that you must come across all the time in crime fiction, which is that, you know, the dead female character,
right. You know,
and then I suddenly realized that I had done it in a way, and my heart sank. But I do think that she's the moral center of the book. There are chapters which detail their relationship, which go back and you know, look at this conversation about loyalty and betrayal, and track her impact and her influence on August and his thinking, and you know, without talking about the ending of the book, I think she plays a part there as well. So it does feel to me that she's an incredibly important part of the story, and her influence is just felt throughout. You know, ripples of her character and things that she said are just sort of echo throughout August's life.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you may be being a bit harsh on yourself there. I think the problem with the victim, you know, when it starts, you the kind of book you read when the first thing you see is the dead young girl on the page,
yeah,
is the idea that it can be somehow a MacGuffin, you know, yeah, rather than an actual real person with real lives. And that's one of the reasons why I quite like victim-centered crime now, that sort of explores the other avenues and explores what it is to the victim, not so much the killer. There is another aspect, though, of the two characters, and it goes to what this thing that we used to call mice, you know, which appeared a lot in fiction, and particularly Cold War fiction, about motivations for committing treason or motivations for jumping off, you know. And you wanted to take a look at that from a newer perspective, didn't you, or from a modern perspective, or try and come up with something else. Can you explain a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, I wanted the structure of How to Betray Your Country to feel a little bit fractured.
Right.
And I think this was in part because, you know, I wanted the texture of the book to at least reflect the fact that it was about a protagonist who was going through a kind of breakdown that you know, started off the book in a bad place and, you know, went to some, you know, even worse places through the course of the book. And so I didn't want the book to feel like a smooth wall of prose coming towards you, where you know everything is neatly laid out and everything is wrapped up, and there's a nice tidy ending, and so on and so forth. So there are four parts to the story, and I've given each one a kind of title, and the titles come from the acronym MICE that you mentioned there, which are as you said, so money, ideology, coercion, and ego or excitement is another way that the E is explained. Traditionally MICE is a shorthand for spies when thinking about how they're going to recruit an agent. This is a way of thinking about what might motivate the person to become an agent. And becoming an agent invariably means betrayal. So, you know, you ask someone to become an agent because they have access to a target or a person of interest. You don't just go to an ordinary person on the street who runs a greengrocer and say, fancy being an agent. I mean, there's no point to that. So the question, do you want to become an agent? The other half of that question is, do you want to betray, you know, your friend, your colleague, your country, whatever it is? And so these are ways traditionally that spies have thought about bringing someone on board. So paying them money or persuading them that the ideology of the person or the country they're betraying is a bad one and they should come onto your side because your ideology is better. You know, coercion is a very old-fashioned one, you know, blackmail effectively. Mm-hmm. And then I think, you know, probably the most powerful one is ego, which is, you know, finding a way, well, understanding what that person thinks about themselves and how they see themselves, what they think their values are. Mm. And then through a long period of conversation, trying to help them see their values and their self-identity as aligning with what you're presenting them with. And you know, those four titles, then money, ideology, coercion, and ego, as the four section headings, you know, they don't literally describe what comes after that, what comes in the story, but they're just kind of signposts I wanted to stick there for the reader to see and to think about. Because if they're reading a book called How to Betray Your Country, I wanted them to think about, you know, what loyalty meant for them and, you know, what it would take for them to step outside of a set of rules that they've signed up to, what it would take for them to misbehave, you know, what ethics mean for them. So it's just really a way of prompting that thought.
Yeah, I see that. So given that this is a pretty organic, how organic a process is this for you? Because I'm trying to figure out where you get the character, you know, and then is it the character's agency that kind of then propels the story?
Yeah, it all comes from character, really, I think.
Right.
And I think it's very hard, or at least I find it very hard, to separate plot from character.
Right.
Because the plot, the character's decisions obviously spring from who they are as people and how they express themselves and their position. You know, there's this old cliche about, you know, I was surprised by what my characters did, as though, you know, they've suddenly come to life and they've taken control of the story. I wouldn't quite go that far, but I really need to Personally, I feel that I really need to start writing and thinking and feeling my way into a character and hearing them speak and sort of refining that and seeing what they look like before it comes to me that they're going to behave in this way or that way. And I read I'm reading a very good book by George Sanders, the American short story writer. He's written a very good book about Russian short stories. And he talks about, you know, people often asking a writer how they decided to do this or that, or why did you decide to write it this way? And he quite rightly says that this is just not how it feels on the inside. Mm. And the phrase he uses is intuitive preference. He said, you suddenly find yourself thinking about something and you just find that you quite like the idea of it being a purple coat rather than a blue coat. You don't know why, right. But it's just like, it's just a piece of the puzzle that just fits in neatly. And immediately it's there, it's right. Mm. And it doesn't come as the result of rational decision making. It just suddenly feels right. And you know, I always try to have some version of the framework in my head before I start. But I think I'm learning that trying to, you know, build the whole structure up front is just not something that I can do. Mm. Because as soon as I start writing chapter one, I start feeling my way into it, and then it goes in a different direction.
Yeah, I wonder about that sometimes. I'm never really sure what kind of novel you'd get if you actually had a plan and it just went the way it was supposed to go. It seems that somehow would be lifeless. And of course, one of the things about a novel is it has to appear organic. The lives within it have to appear organic. So what is the best way to present character? I find myself less interested in exposition as a reader. And I think you've said before that you don't really like connecting material. I think that was something you mentioned when we spoke before. Mm. So, I mean, is it dialogue or is it perhaps getting inside the narrator's head, you know?
Yeah, I think a character is particularly important. I think it's also particularly important in the context of a spy novel because spies themselves are very interested in characters. So, you know, we were talking just now about recruiting an agent. So, you know, a spy would think about the possible motivations of this person. What kind of a person is he or she, and what would motivate them, and how do they see themselves? The spy might also think of their adversary and think, you know, what are they plotting to do, and how can I frustrate what they're doing, and what sort of choices are they going to make? So the spy is thinking a lot, you know, think a lot about character, because it is really a profession about relationships, about people. Mm. In terms of how the character is created, I think dialogue is really important, and there are some, you know, American crime novelists who I adore, like George V. Higgins, who wrote The Friends of Eddie Coyle, or Elmore Leonard, or Richard Price, who are just absolute masters of dialogue that reads on the page as though it's realistic. You know, it is an incredible skill in how they do it. That you read it and you think, well, they just sat on a bus and copied a conversation they heard two people having. But of course it's not. It's an artifact. It's a piece of artistry that they have managed to pack those words with little bits of poetry and little sparks of humor, but also enough information to keep the plot moving along. And there's always conflict in these things. Conflict is so essential to drive the story forward. I think dialogue is really important, trying to find a voice for your character. And then, as I said earlier, you know, putting that character in a position of huge stress, of crisis, and then seeing, you know, which way are they going to go? They could go one of several different directions here. But by that point, you might have an idea of what kind of a person they are, and suddenly a path opens up to you.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I wrongly assumed the last time we spoke, and you've already hinted at this, actually, that you had envisaged a trilogy from the start, and we find out that's not the case. That actually came with the second novel. In what way is it a trilogy, though? Because it's not an ongoing story.
No, it's not, and I'm not even sure that trilogy is the right word for it. I don't know if there's a better one. I mean, as I said, the first one felt like a standalone, and then I started writing the second, and it felt like it was connected. Mm-hmm. The third one is also connected. I suppose the link between them is that although there are separate protagonists going through entirely independent stories, all of these stories happen against the same backdrop. So there are background characters who recur, who reappear between the books, while the central characters are different. And in the second book, of course, we learn that August did know Jonas, who was the protagonist of the first book, and
yes,
the, you know, they were friends of a sort. And the protagonist of the third book has is aware of both Jonas and August. So they're kind of aware of each other in this little enclosed universe, but their stories are independent. And I suppose the, you know, if there is an overarching title for the trilogy in my head, I would call it The Discipline Files, because it feels to me, and this is something that's enlarged on considerably in the third book, but it feels to me as though we, you know, there is a file somewhere in Whitehall, a dusty buff colored file that if you flip open, it's got details of all the serious miscreants from the last 10 years in the intelligence community, people who've, I don't know, you know, taken drugs or had affairs with their agents or stolen money or whatever it is. And I sort of imagine that in that file, there's the story of Jonas and there's the story of August and there's the story of the protagonist of book three.
I really like that idea.
So they kind of thematically they're connected. It happens in the same landscape. There are references to each other in their books, but I think that they could be read in any order.
Right. Yeah. Let me ask about that then. You said trilogy. I'm not sure if that's the right word, but the third book. Am I right in saying that it kind of bookends the other two?
It does. I guess is different from books one and two in two significant ways. The first is that it takes place in the UK.
Right.
The first book I wrote, Beside the Syrian Sea, takes place in Beirut. The second one in Istanbul.
Yes.
So the third one's in the UK. And also it's not, again, this is something I thought, I thought it would be a trilogy to do with counterterrorism, but it turns out, to my surprise, that book three is Russian themed. But in other ways, it continues the,
Zeitgeisty.
Yes, exactly. But yes, in other ways, it sort of continues the theme, and I think brings the story to a close. The story of these two characters to a close. The file, the discipline file, is closed at the end of book three.
Right. In that sense, then you said trilogy is not the right word. Could you almost see it as one book? Because sometimes I feel that when trilogies and quadruples, you know, come together, that they actually quartet. I should have said there actually. That when they come together, there is something that makes them seem like a whole again, you know, as if it's one form.
Yeah, it's a very interesting idea. I don't see why that couldn't be the case. I mean, I you know, it's interesting that with Le Carré, you know, a lot of his characters reappear from one book to another. And we don't really think of Le Carré having written trilogies and so on. I know that, you know,
people no, now you mention the it, we Smiley don't. Books. No.
And so he somehow seems to have escaped that. So I don't know.
And yet they clearly
do
follow on from each other.
Exactly. And yet they clearly do follow on. But they also feel very independent of each other. I suppose the traditional trilogy is one where you're kind of, there's a, you know, end of book one, there's a resolution of sorts, but there's also an inbuilt cliffhanger, a sense of a cliffhanger ending, which is then picked up at the beginning of book two and so on and so forth. So I haven't got that in any way. I think this each book completes the story. There's not much to learn about that story in later books.
It's the thematic links. And how does that how's the third one going then? I mean, where are you at?
I am just finishing it up, so just seeking some external opinions on it, but I think I've got as far as I can get with it, and I'm just getting other people's opinions to see whether it can be tightened up in places. But I'm happy with it. It felt like it was one of the most difficult to write. And I don't know if that is to do with lockdowns and COVID and the difficult 2 years that everyone has had. And I know that a lot of writers have speculated as to whether there is something, you know, something from being deprived of daily human contact with people that then obstructs their output of words. You know, I think writers see themselves as fairly solitary, that they can easily lock themselves away and just write all day, every day. But maybe one thing that writers have learned in this process is that they just, you know, it's not quite that simple, that they need to be seeing people and different people and having different conversations. So it felt like a very difficult process for me. And then I put it away for a little bit, didn't look at it. And I came back to it and I felt a lot happier about it at that point than I did during the writing of it.
So in a sense, does having a day job help then?
I mean, so in one sense, I think you're right. It does, because it takes your mind away from the book, and it exposes you to the real world.
Hmm.
But I think it is tremendously difficult to write in the margins of a day job. I mean, I have done it, but it takes a lot of energy.
Yeah.
I think it can be done for maybe a book or two, but I don't know of many people who've sustained a whole career doing that. I think it becomes pretty tiring after a while.
Yeah. I mean, it's only good then if it's a hobby, isn't it, rather than your profession. Yeah. From one last point on the trilogy, because this is something I must admit that I picked up from your talk with Shane on Spybury, actually. It was something you said about the organization, and it's a really fascinating aspect. It's that we're seeing these as individual stories. So we're looking at Jonas and August and whoever the third character will be in the next novel. But actually, there's an incremental effect on the organization itself. Can you talk about that a little bit, please?
Yes, but there is a sense in which the organization reacts to Jonas in book one.
Yeah.
And it sort of, you know, it puts them on a state of alert. So I think what I'm trying to capture in this is the sense of a kind of cultural shift that is underway. I mean, I suppose cultural shifts are always underway. There's you know, it's not that everything is stable and then suddenly it changes. But, you know, as I said, spy agencies these days are much more, you know, diverse, tolerant and open places than they were a generation ago. You know, it's hard to believe it that the chief of MI6 tweets, you know, that MI5 has an Instagram account.
Yeah.
You know, GCHQ has a puzzle book. You know, every week, it seems, or every month, there's a journalist who's invited to come behind the scenes of one organization or another. And, you know, they speak to staff members who speak live on air, live on air. Maybe their voices are disguised. And they talk about the role. And all of this is a bid to make the organizations more diverse and open, because they want to get a more diverse pool of applicants.
Mm.
You know, for the reason that, you know, an organization that exists to operate covertly within a population has to mirror that population. You know, if you have an organization that is filled with white public school boys, then, you know, good luck infiltrating.
There is a limited sphere of where they can go.
Exactly. They can infiltrate the Bullingdon Club, but I don't know how far else they'll get. And so there's this sort of real change underway. And I think what I'm trying to suggest in the books is that alongside that change is a growing concern about what loyalty means. I mean, in this day and age where people travel, where people have, you know, families these days are not exclusively one nationality. My family has several different nationalities, and I expect most people's do. So, you know, what does loyalty mean now, and how can we expect people to be loyal? There's also the kind of just the general sense of obedience that our parents or grandparents' generation might have had, I think is something that's definitely weakened. So as the trilogy goes on, the organizations are definitely thinking, well, something is shifting here. There's a cracking. There is more disobedience. And so each book kind of finds the organization more alarmed. And then this sort of reaches its peak in the third book. But they look at their body of employees and see a diverse community that is increasingly difficult to keep under control.
Mm-hmm. I think that makes a lot of sense. I do think, as I said earlier, I think that's a fascinating aspect as well. Do you see yourself continuing to write spy books after this? You know, something you said to me when we were talking before was about Le Carré, and how, and I think maybe a lot of us thought this, you know, what if he'd stretched out a bit? What if he'd tried to write a different book in the way that Graham Greene wrote different books? You know, is that on your mind? I suppose that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I don't know the answer. I mean, I feel that very strongly about Le Carré, that you know, those of us who admire him, and that is so many people, because he was such a great writer, but I can't help feeling like that there could have been more or different branches to his career, and that something happened with The Naive and Sentimental Lover that just sent him straight back into the arms of spy fiction, and he never left it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've started thinking about book four, and it is a spy novel.
Right.
So I don't know is the answer. It's a really good question, and it's one I think about a lot. It's one I just don't know the answer to at this point. I think I have to wait and see what ideas come to me and where I feel that my instincts.
Just about everything about your career is organic.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. Yes. So I suppose I have to be true to that and see where it takes me.
Okay. Yours are literary spy novels. What is it you think that makes a good literary spy novel? I mean, we've talked about character. What about style?
Yeah. I mean, I think, and I sort of hinted at this already, but I think there is something about the real world of spying that is complex and confusing and uncertain that I would like to see reflected more in spy fiction. I talked earlier on about this kind of, wall of prose. You can read some books that they're narrated by this omniscient narrative voice that knows everything, knows all the minds of the characters. You know who the good people are, you know the bad people are, and then the ending is very satisfying and everything is tied up there. I mean, that couldn't be further from the reality of spying.
No.
People talk about smoke and mirrors to describe the world of espionage. Well, why not import a little bit of the smoke and mirrors into fiction? Why should the fiction not be confusing and challenging and a little bit uncertain? I mean, there's the National Archives at Kew, so intelligence files are released from government control after a certain number of years, and you can go there and have a look at a file. And if you imagine one of these files, you open it up, and then, the first thing in it might be a transcript of a phone conversation between two people, and then you turn that over. Then you might have a report from a foreign country detailing something of concern that's happened in, let's say, Paris, and you turn it over. Then there's a surveillance report of the people mentioned in the previous document. You turn it over. Then there's an agent report. So you have all these documents that are written by different people. They're written in different registers, different voices, but about the same story. And so you read a file as though it is a story, but there are so many gaps. And you're constantly having to think, what's happened between this and this? You have this being said in a phone call, and then suddenly this happens. What's happened in the gap there? And you get to the end of the file, and 99 times out of 100, you're thinking, is that it? Like, what happened next? I remember a colleague saying to me soon after I started in government service, he said he was talking about a sort of particular type of work. He was talking about like the counterintelligence side of things. And he was saying it is like reading the most fascinating spy novel imaginable, but one in which the last 20 pages have been drawn out. And so I suppose when I think about the style and the structure of spy books, I want to try and find a way to mix it up a little bit.
Yeah.
To make the surface of the story a little bit less straightforward.
No, I like that because I think something you said a little bit earlier too about resolution. You know, something that bothers me very much about fiction is when it has a resolution that is, as you say, so firmly fixed that it's like 100% of everything is sorted. And it doesn't make any sense because life just doesn't work like that. And so I'm more interested in as fiction that in a way you have to have a certain level of resolution, but the more you can keep open, the better.
Yeah. And I was thinking about this the other day because I saw an advert for, I think it's a dramatization of one of Ben McIntyre's books, but the one about Philby. And I think the dramatization focuses on the Beirut episode, which is where Nicholas Elliott, who was a fellow MI6 man, went out there to challenge Philby. And no one really knows what was said. I mean, Philby is probably one of the most or the most famous British spy of all time. His case has been pored over. Dozens of books have been written about it. And there is this episode that is at the heart of his story. And 50 years on, we have not a clue as to what happened. Did Nicholas Elliott tip him off? Did he say, listen, old friend, this is around the corner. You better jump ship and run. And so that gives you an indication of how, something that is so important and has been pored over is still, it's how do you write the ending of Philby's story? You can't. We don't know.
Yeah. That's really fascinating, actually, because it's so true that so much of, we think we know stories, and then another aspect throws a different light on it. And it's quite incredible how that happens. This comes back to something else in your books, which was quite a daring thing, I think, in a sense, and it's the use of memos and things. Because you, as you just said there, when you were talking about that file, it made me realize that the file has character, if you like, because it comes from these different sources and because it has different opinions. And you found a way of, most people would say, right, keep the documentation, keep the procedure and all that sort of thing out of a book. But you found a way of making that actually contribute to the story, didn't you?
Well, I've definitely tried to do that. I mean, I think there are, you know, one of the things that drives stories forward is conflict. And you can obviously have conflict between a protagonist and an antagonist. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of the very obvious surface level of conflict. One of the things that makes Cold War fiction so interesting is the class element. You know, if you look at Alec Lemus or some of Len Dayton's books, it comes up again and again and again, these kind of, and you mentioned the Ypres file earlier, but you have this sense of the establishment, and then you have these upstart characters who are doing the really interesting work, but they're constantly rubbing up against this sense of class entitlement that their superiors have. And the genius of that is that it's another layer of conflict. And you want to have your kind of your headline conflict between a protagonist and antagonist, but you want to have as many other frequencies of conflict as you can get into the book. Class is a brilliant one. And I suppose what occurred to me during the writing is that you know, let's say a spy who goes out and is trying to recruit someone who's embedded within a terrorist network, and you know, they're doing that and they come back to the office, then they might have a conversation with a boss who they don't really respect. They then got to get a file their expenses. They're then going to have a meal they don't like in the cafeteria. Then they're told they have to go into a training course that they find is boring, whatever. And all the while they're planning for the second conversation with this potential agent who's in a terrorist network. And you have these different layers of drama and tension and conflict and comedy in their lives. And it just felt to me that it would be too narrow to focus purely on the kind of headline conflict between the protagonist and the antagonist, when there are all these other layers of conflict that are part of a spy's everyday life. And some of those, you know, are comic, and some of those are dramas in their own way. And, you know, I want readers to come at this and understand that, you know, a spy's life is very ordinary in lots of ways. And spy organizations are big bureaucracies. They're risk averse, they're slow moving, it can be enormously frustrating places to work. And so this is kind of what realism is for me. It's about the reader understanding or bringing for the reader's benefit, bringing the spy agencies down from this glamorous superhuman level and showing them that there are all sorts of parallels and overlaps between the reader's life and the lives of these characters.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. When it comes to that, I mean, how important are these things when it comes to the spy novel, then, complexity?
I think there's huge complexity in spying itself, and there are endless leads that are thrown out in millions of different directions. I mean, I often sort of compare, you know, in particular with counterterrorism, you can compare it to the name, what's the name of the Minority Report, the Tom Cruise film, which is all about pre-crime, I think, you know. So you have that in counterterrorism in particular, where you are trying to catch someone before they have committed the crime. Because the crime is unthinkable. You can't wait for them to carry out an attack and then arrest them because you've failed at that point. And so there's huge complexity and nothing is certain. Nothing is black and white. Every little bit of information could possibly take you in a different direction. And the very, very difficult, but very, very important job that spies are trying to do is take that mass of really confusing information and try and discern a clear image within it. You know, what does this mean? Is the balance of probability that it is moving in that direction or that direction or that direction? And, you know, really make these very, very difficult and finely balanced judgments. So I think that that kind of complexity as well has to find a home in a spy novel.
Yeah. So I'm trying to figure out what it is about the best spy novels, you know, that's a kind of constant, if you like, across them. I mean, you've got the moral quandary, but also I think something that people don't appreciate, and I don't think it's the same thing, and it's very apparent in your books, is the emotional quandary. You know, the matters of the heart that the best spy novels always seem to reflect on. I think there's that grounding in reality that you need to have. But when you mentioned conflict earlier, there's several levels of conflict, really, isn't there? There's the conflict, for instance, if we take Augustus as August, sorry, there's the conflict internally. Then there's the conflict with his adversary. And that's a psychological battle between two men. And then you've got the conflict with the organization. So it's quite a complex structure.
Yes. Yeah, it is. I mean, I think, screenwriting gurus will talk about the fact that, you know, when you're plotting out your screenplay, every scene has to have conflict in it. You can't write a single flat scene that is just, yeah, you know, Bob relaxing at home, watching television, having a glass of wine with his wife and, you know, petting the dog. No. If they're doing that, then they have to have a row. There has to always be some layer of conflict. So I think when you're finding your different strands of your novel, you have a sort of maybe a protagonist to antagonist strand, but then you have your spy, and how does he relate to his organization, to his boss, to his colleagues, to his partner? Every single strand has to embody some level of conflict. And then there is also, of course, internal conflict.
Yes.
You know, you don't want, or I'm not so interested in characters who are, you know, completely happy with themselves.
No, clear-sighted, yeah.
I think they're pretty terrific as people and you know, think that they're heroic in some way. I don't think that's particularly interesting. So you have internal and external, and you have the conflict going upwards and sideways in every single direction.
Mm. So when we've been talking about the spy novel now and what we think makes a sort of a literary spy novel, you've been writing a piece, I believe, about the Cold War. Want to tell us about that?
Yeah, so I'm writing a piece for the US website Crime Reads, which really asks the question, you know, what is it about the Cold War that gave rise to so many classics of the genre? Was there something in the air, you know, some kind of unique oxygen mixture that led to all these classics that we're still talking about, you know, 50 years later, 40 years later, and so on and so forth. One of the things I point to in the article is the class issue that we've just talked about. You know, the fact that was really, you know, a strong feature of British society, in particular in the 50s, 60s, 70s. There's also the hangover from the Cambridge spy ring and Kim Philby and the others. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that makes those Cold War books so rich is that, you know, the spies would work within their organization, and they couldn't trust the person sitting next to them. They couldn't trust their boss. You know, in some cases, they couldn't trust their partners. I mean, this sense of the enemy possibly being around every single corner, and it is one, you know, I talked early on about, you know, get as many different layers of conflict and tension as you can. That's a brilliant one, you know, for you to come back to your home organization. But in reality, anyone you come across could be your enemy.
It's really
rich and really, really drives these books forward and gives them a real a kind of
narrative. I mean, it's crucial to Le Carre, and it's crucial to Dayton and others as well, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Yeah. Like, you know, I read Berlin Game for the first time recently. And
I won't
mention the ending of that for anyone who hasn't read it. But that's a real kind of like, whoa, you know, there's there's no dividing line between, you know, our half of the court and their half of the court. You know, the enemy is everywhere.
No, that's a good point, actually, because, again, I would say that one of the things that perhaps we saw more come in with Le Carre, but it wasn't the start of it, is this ambiguity, this fact that everything is a shade of grey. And essentially, it needs to be like that.
Yeah, the morality, the murkiness thing is crucial as well. And I think one of the reasons that the Cold War stuff was so good was because, you know, the murkiness stuff that is good in spy fiction is that sense of ethical ambiguity. You know, it's the idea that the other side are really bad, and in order to defeat them, we're going to have to roll our sleeves up and descend to their level in the gutter. And we're not going to like it. And we're not going to be able to look at ourselves in the mirror afterwards, but it's necessary. You know, we're going to have to do the bad things that they do if we're going to win. And then you end up with this very rich kind of moral ambiguity. And, you know, you've got Smiley and Carla, and, you know, Smiley's wondering whether he's really won after all, you know, given
that absolutely
he's had to take. And I think, you know, and I say this as someone who's written two terrorism themed novels. It's very difficult to get that same level of moral ambivalence when you're writing about terrorist targets, because, you know, I could look at a Russian spy and see all sorts of parallels. You know, they're probably grumbling about their bosses. They don't like everything their bosses do. They don't feel they don't get paid enough. You know, they're just trying to make ends meet. And, you know, you could make a nice, rich parallel between the two there. But if your antagonist is a terrorist who straps a bomb and goes into a shopping center and kills 50 people, it's like, how is there ever going to be any moral equivalence between what the spy does and what that person does?
That's a very interesting point. There are very few Western writers who've got behind that and found a way of making it a very human story from the other side as well. Let me ask you this then. With that in mind, do you think perhaps that's why we've got this sort of trend at the moment to head back to the Cold War? I mean, we can look at it, obviously, we got more documents and so on. Now we can see stuff from the Russian side and the German side, the East German side, that we couldn't see before because files have opened up. But it does seem to me that there is a new focus on the Cold War.
Yeah, I mean, you probably read more widely in spy fiction than I do. So I haven't noticed that trend, but I'm sure you're right in identifying it. I think you're right. I think it's also probably easier to look back. I mean, I think the kind of current landscape is such a confusing one. I mean, if you look at Trump and Brexit, COVID, and now Ukraine, you know, what is spying today? You know, if you look back 50 years, we know what spying was. It was about trying to recruit Russians and
very clear cut.
Very clear cut. And it's you know, the reader comes to that knowing what they expect, and the writer can go to it knowing what the parameters are. You know, the lines of that football pitch are clearly marked. Whereas a modern spy novel, I think, is a much more slippery thing. And quite hard to, you know, to understand what it is or what it's trying to do or what kind of values it's espousing or what values it's trying to describe. It's a lot less. I mean, the point I make in the article is that it's a lot more splintered, a lot more fractured, a lot more confusing. But, you know, what I hope as someone who's trying to write or is writing modern spy novels is that the capacity to surprise the reader is there, because people don't really know what they're expecting with a modern spy novel, because it, you know, because the world is changing so much. Maybe there is the capacity there to really surprise readers in the same way that those Cold War classics really surprised readers at the time.
Absolutely.
And that article's available on Crime Reads.
To it on the show page anyway, so people can catch up with that. Just one last thing then, James. How about a recommendation?
Well,
and I don't mind what it is, you know, something that you've read recently, something you've seen recently. It's entirely up to you.
You gave me a very good recommendation when we spoke last, which is you suggested I look at Edward Wilson, which I've done, and enjoyed his book, The Envoy, very, very much, and have corresponded with him a little bit since then. But yes. I thought that was really interesting. I thought, you know, and I said this to him, that so one of my favorite writers in the crime sphere is James Ellroy. And one of the things he does is write about real historical events and real historical characters and imports them into his novel. And it's something that Edward does as well. And it really kind of injects a kind of frisson of something into the book.
Yes.
I also really like the kind of, you know, I know he's been in the UK a long, long time, but it felt like a very distinctively American voice in a British setting that I thought was really interesting.
Yeah. What I was going to say was, with Edward, you know, I don't necessarily agree with everything he writes, but I can engage with everything he writes. And I like that you can have that sort of debate with the writer about the value of certain events and the importance of certain events over time and that sort of thing. This one I'd recommend just occurred to me because we're trying to think of titles the other day for that thing we were doing with Spybury. and Paul Vidich. And it wasn't a book I mentioned at the time, but I think it fits with this. And that's A Fine Madness by Alan Judd.
Oh, yes. I haven't read any of his books, but I am aware of him. But that's a good one, is it, to start with?
Yeah, because the character, it's Christopher Marlowe.
Mm.
And there are lots of books that link Marlowe with spying and so on. But it's just that I thought, regardless of whether this is Marlowe or isn't Marlowe, it's obviously not. It's Judd's version of. Mm. But I felt I got this character so well that I'd recommend it for that reason. And actually, you know what? Since we've spoke the last time, Frank Gardner recommended your books on the show, didn't he, when he came on and he did a podcast for me? And I was talking to Tim Shipman, who does the list of the 120 top spy novels or top spy novelists for Spybury. And he jumped you into the list after he read your book. That must be gratifying.
Yeah, that was very gratifying. He mentioned, I think, in that conversation that I had sent him a copy of the book, which I hold my hands up. You know, I'm published by a pretty small publishing house, and I sometimes try to engage.
Oh, yeah, you don't have to apologize for that. I mean, no. But honestly, one of the things you can't do is go to a book festival and talk to people, you know, which is what a lot of authors just get the opportunity to do. And of course, it's not quite the same for you. So,
well, I hope I can. I mean, I kind of, you know, we talked about making decisions organically. I'm sort of making, you know, decisions about how public to be organically as well. And I think there is, you know, there are maybe a few years after leaving government service where things are a little bit more sensitive. And I think, you know, as time goes on, that probably becomes less so. So I would love to do that at some point, and, you know, to meet you face to face and have a
drink. Yes,
and
I'll see you at some point.
Read the books. Yeah, that would be great.
Okay. James, that's been fantastic. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you very much, James. It's been really difficult for authors who've had to launch during the COVID crisis, but more and more people are finding out just how good James Wolfe is. His third novel, I anticipate, will be a real cracker. Both Beside the Syrian Sea and How to Betray Your Country, the second novel, are available from Bitter Lemon Press, and you can get them through all good bookshops and online outlets. But if you go to the program page, you'll find there a link to bookshop.org, and you can buy both books there. I'll be back with an interview with Nicola Upson very shortly. But for now, thank you very much for listening, and bye.